I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
You're on Team Human. This is a special episode of the show, recorded live at the Strand Bookstore in New York City with my longtime friend, John Oakes, celebrating the publication of his new book, The Fast, The History, Science, Philosophy, and Promise of Doing Without. John is an especially sweet and modest man, and was the editor at OR Books, responsible for bringing out my book, Program or Be Programmed. It was an honor to be there to midwife his own authorial coming out event. And I invite you to sit back and listen to me try to get John Oakes to accept some credit for his achievements. You know how to draw out a nice crowd. God. All right, so off we go. You're on Team Human, Conscious Intervention in the Machine, coming to you alive from the Strand Bookstore in New York City, celebrating the release of my friend John Oakes' new book, The Fast, The History, Science, Philosophy, and Promise of Doing Without, published by Simon & Schuster, recently rescued from assimilation by the Bertelsmann Empire when it was acquired by a private equity firm, KKR. But that's another story for another day. We're here at the Strand. Those who have had dinner, those who will dine following the event, and those who may choose not to eat at all. It's time to intervene on behalf of people and all living beings. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and you're all on Team Human. So, John Oakes, you've been my friend for maybe 40 years.
Oh, Douglas.
I'm sorry.
Couldn't have been that long, no, Douglas.
Yes, it was.
We're much younger.
It was. And while I know you that you're the publisher of the Evergreen Review, that you're the editor at large for OR Books, which you co-founded in 2009 and published my own book, Program or Be Programmed, among other notable, even revolutionary titles by people from Julian Assange to Yoko Ono. I did not know that
And Douglas Rushkoff.
Oh, thank you. Yes. I did not know that you earned the Princeton English Department's undergraduate thesis prize for an essay on Samuel Beckett, which seems quite fitting for someone who's interested in fasting. We're going to get to that. And somehow that playwright's minimalism He's the guy, you know, who did Waiting for Godot. Somehow his minimalism seems appropriate, appropriate way in to the topic of this evening. So what attracted you to Beckett? And what did you write about his work?
That is an unexpected question from you, Douglas. First of all, thank you so much for that very nice introduction. I really was interested in, got interested in Beckett because I'd heard so much about him and I knew so little. And I ended up by not knowing much, but at least a little bit more. I was hanging out with your crowd at the same university, and Beckett was very present. And I mean, it's hard to study modern English without coming across Beckett or his influence.
And what was the essay about? Like the not knowing which of the two pieces of the cookie to eat and then passing out. Remember that scene in, was that Murphy, I think? Merloy?
It was applying a dialectic, the...
really? Yeah.
Well, it's about applying the Hegelian dialectic to Beckett's work, and that you go through a thesis and then a...
Antithesis,
and then you come out with a synthesis, and yeah.
Well,
supposedly.
I think we're going to come back around to that in the end.
This was a long time ago.
No, but it was interesting. So you were interested in sort of in transcending the duality of thesis to antithesis to synthesis.
Well, I was interested in what Beckett was doing and how he came to it and really the process of his thinking. And I, as I think many in this group, this audience know, he's endlessly fascinating and such a rich source of intellectual ferment.
Right. I mean, for me, reading Beckett is like...
I did not think we would talk about Beckett tonight.
No, but reading Beckett is like being with the soul of another human being, right? Actually, he's present. When you're reading a novel, he is there with you, dead or... And it, to me, it's the minimalism of the work that lets the soul shine through.
And I see how you're maybe tying that into fasting. For me, what was interesting and what I think it's his maximalism, because he's so immersed in the universe and in cataloging it. And I think that was something that I found amazing, his attention to detail and to intellectual detail and how he didn't, I think, most of us, most normal human beings, shy away from that and pull back. And Beckett just totally is, as I say, immersed.
So, to the subject of this book, how did you discover the fast? Why did you choose to commit to fasting as a path for self-discovery? Or more simply, what possessed you?
Well, a long time ago, not quite as long as when I met you, Douglas, but a long time ago, my partner at the time and still now introduced me to the concept of fasting. And she's Swiss German, and that's very much a part of the culture there. And being Jewish, I'd only been really acquainted personally with fasting on Yom Kippur, as you know, the Day of Atonement.
Right.
And that's always a big deal. It's one day. And here I was being told that you could fast quite comfortably for, you know, 5 days, 6 days, maybe 8 days. And that seemed really wacky to me. But I did it. And it, for me, it was really, I guess, an empowering experience. But that was enough. And I left it alone for a long time. And it was only with the departure of... Trump, that I really wanted to take it up again because I just wanted to purge myself. And it was just a spur of the moment thing. And we undertook a week long fast. And then in the course of that, I got interested in the history of fasting and some of the philosophy behind it and what it does to your body. And it really seemed to me interesting. And I hope I conveyed that.
So when you started, were you scared when you started it?
Scared isn't quite the word I'd use. You mean the first time I fasted?
Yeah.
I thought there's no way I could do this. It's just something beyond me. And it seemed like something that was I was incapable of doing. And then when I actually did it, I thought, oh, that's kind of good to know. You know, I can pretty comfortably go for a week or more, perhaps, without food. And that was that. I didn't feel a need to revisit it until Trump.
Right. But but you learned that fasting is a tradition. I mean, even as Jews, you know, we know we're supposed to fast on Yom Kippur, and most Jews mistakenly think it's like that's the atonement, right? That you're fasting in order to punish yourself for your sins, or you can't eat a whole day and then God will love you again, when actually you're fasting in order to be open and pure for the ritual of the day.
Well, I guess there are many different opinions about this, what the fast means, but I think generally the idea, if you're Jewish, the concept is you're it gives you a moment to reflect on your past sins over the year and then to atone for them. And similar that attitude is also similar, I think, in much of Christianity during Lent, which just started, this idea of self-mortification, that it's something that the fast launches you on a sort of a period of punishment for your sins. And what's interesting is in Islam, at least what I've read and the people I spoke to told me, it's very different perception of the fast. It's a period of families coming together and rejoicing. And in the evening, you know, it lasts, I think, 40 days. And in the evening, people gather and they have feasts. And it's just a very different attitude towards fasting.
So it's not about self-denial so much as an opportunity to celebrate. It's almost more like Sukkot would be to Jews or something. It's a festival.
Yeah, not quite. It's a time to contemplate, but it's not so much, the emphasis isn't on self-punishment, I think.
You studied a bunch of different traditions.
I did.
Yeah, which were the ones that were like the most weirdest, fascinating ones? Or which one felt the most true to what was happening in your fast?
I am completely Jewish, but I liked the sense of empowerment and the emphasis on family that I found in what I read and what I heard from imams about Islam. I liked that. I mean, it's in just about every major religion except for the Sikhs and the Zoroastrians. They're the two religions that don't fast. And I think the Sikhs, and I don't mean to set myself up as some kind of expert on Sikhism, but the Sikhs don't do it as a way to differentiate themselves from Hindus and Muslims. I mean, it says that in their holy book. And the Zoroastrians, the belief is that you're put on this earth to fight evil. And therefore, they don't want people to fast because that they feel that would weaken the body. But of course, you know, I'd argue that you come out of a fast feeling better about yourself and probably being healthier than when you went in. So,
I mean, it's interesting. In the West, I feel like our understanding of fasting is framed really in one of two ways. Either it's a sort of anorexics need to control, you know, what's going in or not. Or, you know, and that's sort of the negative way of fasting here. Or it's like, you know, the stoicism of the Navy SEALs, you know, eat 3 grams a day for 9 years, you know, whatever. There's some great new plan. You're going to do intermittent fasting or extramittent fasting, you know, and neither of those really reflect the spirit of fasting.
Yeah, but I think there was, until really the 19th century, there was also in this country a sense of fasting as starting at least with the European settlers, starting with the Puritans, who felt that it was a way to get God's attention. And then right through the 19th century, you had American presidents who would call regularly for days, national days of fasting and humiliation and prayer. And they always did it in the same sequence, which became, I think, a kind of a Protestant mantra. And it was only Lincoln, I think, he called for 3 fasting days, and he changed the order, which I thought was interesting. He emphasized humiliation rather than, you know, the fasting and prayer. But it was a national day of fasting, so...
But like when you fast, did you feel like you gained any insights into like eating disorders and how those work, you know, as you did it? Or is it just so far, totally foreign from that?
Well, you mentioned anorexia, and that's really fasting without end. And for me, it's very important that the fast have sort of borderlines. But I don't think during the fast I had insight into eating disorders. But again, you know, I'm not an expert on that, but it spurred me to look into that and to what makes people do that kind of thing. And it seems to be a mix of psychology and genetics. And does that answer your question?
In a way, yeah. I mean, there's something about fasting feels like it's an exercise of agency. I'm exercising absolutely the choice not to eat.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, it definitely, and that's exciting to me, this idea that you're stepping out of what we call automaticity of your unthinking behavior and just not sort of doing what you've always done. And by the way, there are many different kinds of fasting, of course. It doesn't have to be fasting from food. It could be fasting from sleep, fasting from whatever. And this idea that you can almost reset yourself, even if it's for a short time, I thought was really interesting and freeing in a way. Even if you go back into your old habits, mm-hmm. as maybe you should, to take a break from things and consider what you consume and how you consume it, I think can be very rewarding.
But it didn't take on for you like the, you know, the Tony Robbins, we're going to walk across coals and show that I've made it 7 days with no calories.
I didn't do that. No. And I think it becomes dangerous and highly questionable when people feel they use fasting as a way to push their physical limits. For me, that's not what it's about. And obviously, that can have very dangerous, even fatal consequences. And I don't think that's helpful. But it does, you're mentioning that brings up these fasting celebrities of the 19th century. People used to pay money to watch people fast for a month or more. And some of them were clearly frauds, right. But you know, some of them might not have been. And they got good money doing it. And in fact, in Central Park, there's a spring called Tanner Spring, which is named after Henry Tanner, who was one of these fasting celebrities. And people came, and I think he was a fraud, but people came to him and said, you know, how did you manage to fast so long without eating? And he said, well, I got the water I drank came from this very special spring in Central Park, and it's called Tanner Spring. Look it up.
Oh, well, you know, there's all these, what are they called, breatharians?
Yeah.
Can you live on air?
They claim to, Douglas, but I would not recommend it. No, there's a whole bunch of course, spinoffs and frauds around fasting and even, I think.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Lesser versions of that, people who say that if you fast, it will cure everything from depression to cancer. And maybe, you know, some people are helped, but the evidence is does not show that. But it seems to be that now and again, if you can give your body a break, it can be a good thing.
It was interesting. I didn't actually have this first response, but when I looked at the book, the first thing I was thinking was, people are going to think this is about stoicism of some kind, you know, especially these days of indulgence and, oh, stoicism. And you even remark in the book that the tradition of fasting is closer to hedonism.
Well, the original understanding of hedonism, which is that, or which comes from the Epicureans, who felt that the sensations of our body were signposts on how to live correctly, and that using what we experience in the real world as a guide to how to behave.
God, isn't that a novel idea? I mean, as opposed to what we experience in some virtual world or social network, I mean, that our actual experience in life should inform the way we behave and treat each other in life. I'm going to try this. This is revolutionary.
Very, very well put. Yeah. Yeah. No, that the Epicureans, if you go back to Epicurus, who of course now is associated with overindulgence, he really, as far as we know, because of course all this is thousands of years ago, was making the case that moderation is what we should aim for. And he was also, by the way, a very democratic philosopher, unlike many of his contemporaries who would only teach wealthy men. Epicurus made a point of opening his school to everybody. And I guess that also prejudiced me in his favor. Yeah, his big thing was that we use the body as a way to steer us to correct behavior.
I mean, what the hedonism or the Epicurus also called to mind for me was the kind of, there's a loveliness to fasting that you describe, that the closest sensation I can really think of that I've had to it is like in yoga class, sometimes you do breathing exercises and you can sort of lock here and lock down on your, and you do a big inhale and then hold it. And for a while, it's like, I'm holding my breath. And then it's like, wait a minute, I'm just here. You know what I mean? You kind of push through that thing and you're in this plateau. It's like, oh my God, I feel like I could do this forever. If I'm going to breathe again, it's just going to be by my choice. You know,
that's a really nice connection, Douglas. And I think like yoga, fasting can be, it induces a kind of meditative experience in you if you do it for a while. You know, again, I don't want to also sound like I'm advocating it. Just for me, it was a very powerful experience, and it did induce that kind of meditation you're talking
about.
And
there's the part that's interesting to me, I'm just a transitions kind of guy, but is the moment, and you've done it a number of times, so I'm really interested in the moment when it changes from I'm hungry to you know?
Yeah, yeah. So it's obviously got to be different for everyone because everyone has a different kind of body. But generally, after the first 48, 72 hours, if you're on a liquid-only fast, it's a little uncomfortable and you're still thinking. Your enteric nervous system, which has about the same number of neurons as a dog's cerebral cortex, I guess it depends on the dog, but that's generally the analogy. The enteric nervous system is sending all these messages to your brain saying, you know, what the hell are you doing? You haven't fed me, and go out and, you know, chase down an antelope and eat it. But your brain is asserting itself and is redirecting your body. So that takes, usually that struggle when you're feeling uncomfortable, I'd say, lasts 48 to 72 hours. And then you have this really cool cocktail of chemicals that starts kicking in, a whole bunch of them. There's serotonin, which is sometimes called the happy hormone, starts building up. And there's other stuff like, or I mean, I can list them, but it's really interesting how your body reacts to that. And sort of you get to this plateau of, I don't want to overstate it, but it's almost approaching some sort of serenity. And then you go on from there. Some people feel that it really transforms them. Cesar Chavez, the labor organizer who was really into fasting, he said that by about day five, he would have this incredible memory and he could recall and conversations down to the word. That unfortunately didn't happen to me. But by after a few days, you know, I feel okay.
You didn't do like a colonoscopy at the end just because you're, it's free, right?
Yeah, I did not.
All right, just because I would book it right for the last day there. It would be perfect. But as long as you're onto Cesar Chavez,
yeah.
Politics of fasting.
Mm.
I mean, you know, the last big ones I was hearing about was what they were doing at Guantanamo Bay. I mean,
yeah, that was the largest mass fast that I came across. I think it was about 100, maybe 200 people were fasting. And according to the U.S. military, I think if you skip 9 meals in a row, they consider you fasting. In that case, they went very quickly to force feeding, which, as you may know, is a
violent
and brutal, really, from everything I've read and heard, it's a really brutal procedure and very dangerous, too. And also, I don't want to call them idiots, but the U.S. Army was putting tubes into people's rectums. And obviously, as a doctor in testimony pointed out, we don't absorb food through our rectum. So this really did nothing other than brutalize these prisoners who were already on the edge even more. But even when force feeding is done correctly through your throat, it's a very dangerous procedure. You can puncture internal organs and things, but I don't think you wanted to get into force feeding.
No,
so much.
I mean, there's a lot of political implications even of fasting. So there's fasting as, you know, the political prisoner or Gandhi or until we stop this pipeline, we're going to fast. And, you know, there's that. But then the doing without, and you even mention it in the book, it's akin to a degrowth philosophy. We live in a society that's about, I mean, we're practically Ferengi here, if you want the Star Trek reference, right? We're a society of acquisition. And when we do without, we're doing it. I'm going to acquire 100,000 acres and put nothing on it, right? And then, you know, I'm still having it, right? It's, or how many experiences can I have? Even if you talk about fasting, oh, I'm going to get in 20 more fasts before I die. You know, and I'm going to do one in Costa Rica and one with a shaman, you know, and one on the North Pole. You know, it's like more, more, more. But fasting as a philosophy is like, no, wait a minute, enough.
Well, it depends on how, I mean, fasting can be an acquisitive process. You want to be healthier than anyone else. You want to live longer. And then it becomes a process of acquisition. But the kind of fasting that's connected to politics, I guess in a way it is also acquisitive in that you are saying, you are asserting agency over your own body and you're demanding dialogue with someone or something that's in authority. And this has been this is an ancient fasting tradition. I mean, in Ireland, it goes back, you know, it's time of the Druids when they would fast on someone's doorstep. If someone owed you money and they wouldn't acknowledge the debt, you would fast on it. And there were actually laws.
Sounds like my grandmother or something. I'm going to fast on your doorstep
until
you come for Rosh
Hashanah. But there were laws in pre-Christian Ireland against illegal fasting. But because the idea was that when you fasted, you opened the door to a spiritual realm, which was very powerful. And the person you were fasting against had to acknowledge the wrong, or else they in turn would fast, and then you'd have sort of a stomach duel.
But imagine that. Illegal fast on 114th Street.
Yeah.
Unauthorized.
And in India, fasting against people is still done now as a way to assert the purity of someone's cause and really show your commitment to whatever it is you're objecting to.
You know, you brought up degrowth in the book, though, the concept of degrowth, which I've been pushing on with Team Human for a long while.
That,
one of them, at least, I'm trying to publicize the idea that, well, what if, you know, instead of keeping to grow the economy, you know, what if we didn't have an interest-bearing currency that required growth? What if we can reach some steady state enough?
Yeah.
What did that have to do with fasting for you? And why did you bring that up in the book?
Because for me, fasting is a way to step off of the treadmill we're all on unconsciously or consciously. And it's a way to take a break from routine, which lulls us into thinking that there's a certain way of doing things, which is the way it has to be done. You have to wake up and eat breakfast and do whatever, because that's what you did yesterday. And a fast is a break, and it forces you to reconsider that what you're doing and be a little bit, and maybe you go back to that routine, but at least it enables you to consider what you're doing for a brief time. And then if you're like me, you forget everything you learned, and then you got to do it all over again.
But it does feel a little taboo. I mean, I imagine when you're hanging out in your life, whatever, and you say you meet somebody you haven't seen in a few days, and oh yeah, I'm on the fourth day of a fast.
Huh. Yeah, I try, if I'm fasting, I try right. not to advertise that. I say in the book, you know, St. Jerome said that it's really reprehensible to boast about fasting, and he has a point there on very little else. But he was a real misogynist and absolutely bonkers. But I'm sorry if I've offended any
misogynists here.
Right? Any followers of St. Jerome. You know, he was very important to the early Christian church. But fair enough.
Well, let's go to the funnest part of it. Very first book I ever wrote was called Free Rides, Ways to Get High Without Drugs. And one of the sections was about fasting, because fasting does eventually kind of get you high.
Yeah, there's something called the faster's high, which people
better than the runner's high, even, I bet.
Yeah, which I think people experience, one does experience to varying degrees, but I mean, I've never
But there's no mushroom plant involved. I mean, is there like a learning? Is there a connection to all things?
Except for yourself. I've
just sense of awe?
I've never had visions, though this is a part of many indigenous traditions, that you go off somewhere and you fast for a whole bunch of days, and then some people, I guess, have visions. This is not occurred to me.
The boundary of self doesn't go under dissolution, and you're connected to all matter and energy?
Well, you know, I think what's interesting is the consistent discussion of fasting in these contexts, whether it's indigenous or, you know, whether it's Judaism or Catholicism or whatever, or Islam, the idea that you're opening a realm to something that's not in the here. Well, it's in the here and now, but it's not perhaps as physical as what we our senses are tied to, that it might take you somewhere else. That doesn't extend to mushroom experience, but
right.
it's maybe a cousin to that.
Right.
And some of the, as I say, some of the chemicals involved are, you know, very serious, like orexin A, which has been, you know, sort of zips you up, and serotonin and GHB, and there are many, many others that your body starts producing when you're on a fast after a while.
On a biological, spiritual level, which I sort of see as the same thing, right? But that's another topic. But it feels like the body sometimes asks you not to eat. Like, if you're going to sit down to dinner and you get a call, your mom's sick or your kid's sick, you can't eat. All of a sudden, you can't eat. You can't. And as I was reading the book, I was thinking, well, maybe that's your body getting ready for compassion. I'm going to have to metabolize the trauma of the. So your body goes, of course, no food. You know, so it seems to me almost that foodlessness, that being empty, allows you to do that, the real processing, the real work of being here.
That's interesting. That ties into your idea of degrowth, that, and this idea of Simone Weil, that it's necessary to pull back, to withhold oneself in order for creation and compassion to occur. And that's a kind of fasting, this sense that, or that's a byproduct of fasting, that it's by stopping things and pulling back and allowing room for something else to occur, that it does.
Right. I mean, because as adults now, you know, I mean, we've been with children in pain. We've been with parents dying, you know, and now that I know what that experience is, the kind of almost death doula like experience of compassion, I can understand the prerequisite for a kind of emptiness in order to do that. And to do it without that happening, to do that by choice, to go into a state of emptiness, it seems to me that it would have for you in the hype, it would have elicited a sense of compassion for, you know, humanity, life, and planet.
Yeah, it could. I can imagine that. I mean, emptiness is also very frightening. I mean, it evokes death and non-being. But what I found, at least, about the fast, especially if you do it with someone else as a partner, that it's a sense of shared community. And I think that you see that today with all over the world, as we all know, you know, there are hunger strikes going on at any moment. And, you know, with Brown University just the other week, a solidarity with Palestinians, and they didn't achieve their goal. But even just the act of fasting, I think they all shared that experience. And that, I think, can be strengthening.
You know, fasting together.
Right. We all went through this together. And I mean, that's true for, you know, was true for the IRA prisoners in the 70s and 80s and earlier. And yeah, there's a long tradition of that.
You know, at the same time, you know, as I read the book, and this is part of what made me think of certain aspects of Beckett too, oddly enough, is this, that fasting is a bit like going into darkness. It's a bit like losing track of what's inside and what's outside, or going into an isolation tank, that it's like this, you're like experiencing non-duality or this kind of existential,
maybe a oneness even.
Right.
Yeah, no, that's beautifully put, Douglas.
But that's what, you're the one who put it. I mean, that these ideas, I mean, because so much of the Buddhist path is about breaking distinction, right?
Yeah.
No preference. I'm not going to prefer this over that. I'm not going to distinguish this from that. And it's almost as if when you describe fasting, it's like, oh, it's bringing you into that place of, you know, it's like everything, it's the world is not either creatures that I will eat or creatures that will eat me.
Right. It may not bring you into that place, but it points you towards it. And it suggests there might be another way of being or non-being that is worth consideration.
It's worth consideration. So if it's worth consideration, and I know you don't want to position yourself as an advocate of fasting for all people or any people, but there's people here, there's people reading the book. Some people would think that if you publish a book about fasting, you might be suggesting others might want to at least vicariously experience it. But I have a feeling people are going to think, huh, you know, it's a good, cheap way to try something new. There's no lessons. What's your sort of recommendation? I know you're not a medical doctor, so you can't say, okay, 3 days on brown rice and then water and then this. But what should they, other than reading your book to understand what you got out of it and how it works and what's the history and all, where would they want to, how would you recommend they intelligently explore the possibility for themselves?
Well, I really, really would never suggest to people that they should fast. And I think a lot of what fasting confers can be gotten just by thinking about it and what the process is.
But John, I want to fast. I want to fast. What do I do?
Go ahead and fast. But I think because it prompts us to think about consumption, I think even just thinking about some of the lessons that come out of it and what it implies, you can get many of the
right. It's like Feldenkrais, right? You know, if ever do Feldenkrais exercises, you do the exercise on one side of your body, then you imagine doing it on the other side of your body, and the other side gets the same freedom of motion as the side that did the exercise. So we can just imagine ourselves fasting and not have to actually fast. Oh, good.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. But if somebody were to say that and they were in reasonably good health and, you know, and it wasn't, you weren't approaching it from a sort of a punitive point of way, I'd say it's easiest to do it with a partner. And then you could both complain to each other about how miserable you feel for the first 2 or 3 days. And then you start feeling okay and maybe get a little spacey and, you know, but yeah, I mean, you have to drink a lot. And as you say, I'm not a doctor, and people should undoubtedly get a checkup or something right. before doing something like this.
And you kind of wind and down. And you don't just eat a giant steak dinner and then stop, right? That's not the that's not the method, is it?
I wouldn't eat a giant steak dinner, but I think there are a million ways to go on a fast, and I'm not sure what would be correct. And by the way, there are plenty of these institutes out there, these spas that will charge you thousands and thousands of dollars for the privilege of withholding food from you,
right. and signing away all medical liability before you
get there. And that seems to me really insane, but right. people do it. And
you can spend more on a fast than on food, right?
Yeah,
that's great.
And people spend thousands of dollars, you know, on these clinics and True North in California and other places, you know.
But you get pampered along the way,
right? I'm sure it's very comfortable.
Would you like a facial with your fast? Yeah,
just a massage. Yeah. This won't take very long, but I did want to thank, first of all, The Strand for hosting this event, and specifically Carson Moss and Walker Iverson. Walker, thank you for your very nice introduction, and Elena Esposito and Tika Chidtarto. And I want to thank you, Dr. Douglas Rushkoff, humanist supreme. And if you're not familiar with his books, I hope you will shortly be. Team Human, and the latest is
Survival of the Richest.
Survival of the Richest.
Non-fasters, they are.
Yeah, the very much non-fasters. And Douglas has, for a long time now, been warning us about the digital morass in which we immerse ourselves voluntarily and suicidally. And in closing, this wasn't easy to get Douglas to let me do. I'm going to read all of, I timed it at 30 seconds. So this is a poem by a 17th century Marathi saint who called Tukaram, and sometimes known as Tuka. And it was translated for this book by a wonderful publisher who goes by the name Anand. O Lord, give me smallness, a granule of sugar that the ant gets, Arawat, Indra's jewel of a mount, gets beaten by a mahout. Those who grow big and famous will suffer the blows of fate. Tuka says, to know this is all. We must grow smaller than small. A flood sweeps trees away. Grasses find a way. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Team Human is produced by Joshua Chapdelin and edited by Luke Robert Mason. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and you've been on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.